Last week I started reading a book about a army chaplain who was assigned to the minister to the Nazi war criminals at Nuremberg, and one of the men in particular he was assigned to was the third highest ranking Nazi to be hung at Nuremberg. There were some higher ranking Nazis who'd killed themselves before they could be hung, but this one in particular had been a brutal man, and this American Army chaplain just began to minister him out of this chaplain's theology was such that grace is grace, all people need it. And I got to thinking about his story this morning from our fighter verse. Fighter verse, by the way, means not a verse to go fight with people over, but it means fight the good fight of the faith. And Jesus said, I didn't come to call the righteous, but sinners. And really, the truth is there are no one is righteous. There are just people who think they have something to offer God, and then those who know they don't have anything to offer God. And so as I thought about that Nazi war criminal, he began to, over the course of a year and a half, he was imprisoned in this long trial, his heart began to turn to God and begin to cry out to God for grace and mercy. And I think some people would say, what right does a man like that have to presume that God could offer him grace? And the answer is none. And I thought about our church, and I thought about the people who I've talked to, some of you who feel like that you're someone who has nothing to offer God, and you're sitting in a row of chairs with people who have a lot to offer God, and I assure you that's not the case. There's no one in this room who has anything to offer God. that's what grace is. For many years in Moscow, there was a scientific institute where the brains of great communists were the leaders, scientists, artists were preserved, and then they would slice these brains up and they would analyze their brains under the microscope. Now, why do you think they were doing this? Well, they were trying to find out the secret of great communist personalities by looking in those little communist brains. And it sounds pretty absurd to us, but in the worldview that resided in those great communist brains, materialism, all that exists is a material world. There's no metaphysical, there's no spiritual, there's only the physical. We're just a collection of atoms, nothing more. And so our thoughts, our love, our creativity, our will, our political views, as well as submarines and bombs and satellites, they're all material things. All that exists, seen and unseen, are matter and energy in various forms. There's no difference between the body and the person or the mind and the brain. So why not go looking into the brain to find out what makes a person think or believe a certain thing? Why not go look into a communist brain to find out what makes a communist? Neurosurgeon Jeffrey Swartz, in his book, The Mind and the Brain, and he's written two others, he talks about how the new technology has demonstrated that the mind and brain interaction is much more complex than we ever imagined. And he's not a Christian, but he's also not a materialist. And he talks about what's now commonly known as neuroplasticity, that what we think about or what happens to us changes the physical structure of our brains. And so this has implications for addictions. When choices that people make alter the actual physiology of a brain. The good news is you can retrain your brain, restructure your brain by your will, by habits, by thinking thoughts over time. It has also implications for brain injuries. Some things formerly thought to be impossible, like recovering from a traumatic brain injury, some of those things are now possible through thinking, through choices, restructures our physical brain. But whether current science agrees or not, it was silly to go looking for the communist in the flesh of his brain. We're spiritual beings who occupy physical bodies, and you couldn't find the real me if you went digging around inside this body. When I die, I'm going to lose this body, but I'm not going to lose myself. Someday I'll be given another body, but I'll remain myself. So my thoughts, my feelings, my will, my love, my personality are not just secretions of my brain. I'm more than the physical me. One materialist secular biologist wrote, "The brain secretes thought as the liver secretes bile." And I wonder if that scientist writes that on cards to his wife. So I made up a card for him. "My dearest wife, as my brain secretes thoughts of our years together, I find it also secreting an unusual amount of love bile for you on this day." So if he tried to live that way, I imagine his wife's brain secreted some thoughts of divorce. But the view that the physical is real and the spiritual is not real or less than real has nothing to do with science. It is an unproven presupposition about the world. There was a really well-known German theologian, very liberal theologian, who was also one of the leading thinkers of the 20th century, named Rudolf Bultmann. And he wrote, "It's impossible to use electric light and the wireless," and students, that meant radio when he wrote, not Wi-Fi, "wireless, and to avail ourselves of modern medical and surgical discoveries, at the same time believe in a New Testament world of spirits and miracles." What do you think about that? You know, you think about for just a minute, you go, yeah, you're right, Rudolf. It is kind of hard to live in the modern times and then read about the New Testament, this world of miracles and demons and stuff. But his arguments aren't coherent. His conclusions are not even rational. And what is it about the invention of electric lights that has anything at all to do with the reality of miracles and the spirituals? I mean, we didn't invent electricity. We discovered it. It was there in the first century. Discovery of one thing, electricity, doesn't exclude the presence of another thing, spiritual reality. Why should it? How could it? And that kind of thinking dominates intellectual life in the West, but it's not based on fact, it's based on presupposition. So here's how the circular reasoning goes. To start with, there is no spiritual reality, only the physical. Therefore, when we discover some new physical reality, it further disproves the spiritual. That's called circular reasoning. We aren't inventing new things about reality, we're just discovering some new things that have always been there. Dallas Willard was a philosophy professor at USC for many years, very respected philosophy professor and a believer, and he said, "Nothing fundamental has changed in our understanding of ultimate reality, what's always been there, or the human self since the time of Jesus." And so he'll go to his colleagues in academia and say, "What's changed in the last 2,000 years regarding knowledge of ultimate reality, what's always been there, and human self, and where is that documented?" And they're always stumped by the question because science can't answer those questions. They have no answer for what's always been here and why. Who are we and why? Willard also said, "Traveling through space and not finding God does not mean that space is empty any more than traveling through my body and not finding me means I'm not there." He said, "God roughly relates to space as we do to our body. He occupies it and overflows it, but can't be localized in it or contained by it." So we sing, "This is my Father's world, and to my listening ears, all nature sings and round me rings the music of the spheres." Spiritual is real, the physical is real. Let's read a historical account of where those two realities were clearly made visible in the life of the Lord Jesus. We're working our way through Mark. Look in Mark chapter 1, verse 21. Let me read it to you. "They went to Capernaum, and when the Sabbath came, Jesus went into the synagogue and began to teach. The people were amazed at his teaching because he taught them as one who had authority, not as the teachers of the law. Just then, a man in their synagogue who was possessed by an evil spirit cried out, 'What do you want with us, Jesus of Nazareth? Have you come to destroy us? I know who you are, the Holy One of God.' 'Be quiet,' said Jesus sternly. 'Come out of him.' The evil spirit shook the man violently and came out of him with a shriek. The people were all so amazed that they asked each other, 'What is this? A new teaching and with authority. He even gives orders to evil spirits and they obey him.' News about him spread quickly over the entire region of Galilee. As soon as they left the synagogue, they went with James and John to the home of Simon and Andrew. Simon's mother-in-law was in bed with a fever, and they told Jesus about her. So he went to her, took her hand, and helped her up. The fever left her, and she began to wait on them. That evening after sunset, the people brought to Jesus all the sick and demon-possessed. The whole town gathered at the door. And Jesus healed many who had various diseases. He also drove out many demons, but he would not let the demons speak because they knew who he was." At Capernaum, where this ministry was going on, was on the north side of the Lake of Galilee, and it was Peter's hometown. And it became a sort of base of operations for Jesus' ministry in the north. And a synagogue was a local place of Jewish worship, also a center of community life. And so Jesus went in there and began to teach with authority, as opposed to those who were the regular teachers of the law, the scholars. They didn't teach with authority. Remember last week, a kingdom is the realm of a king's effective will. And this word authority here is a kingly word. It means dominion. He's demonstrating he's the king, and the world is the realm of his effective will. On the other hand, these teachers, these scholars who were trained in interpreting biblical law, they didn't teach with authority. They were simply parroting what they'd heard. But Jesus taught what seemed like new stuff to them, but it really wasn't new. It was really quite old. But it seemed new and was powerful because he was the originator of the teaching and the author of the reality of which it spoke. He spoke with authority, dominion, power. He's a king in his kingdom. All of reality is the realm of his effective will. So he's teaching about his authority, his dominion, and then perfect. A demon-possessed man interrupts the service. So now he's communicating his authority. He gets to demonstrate it. A living illustration of power. So this man had a plurality of demons with one spokesdemon, and the demons recognized Jesus for who he was and what he'd come to do. You are the Holy One, and you've come to destroy us. Hebrews 2:14 says, since the children, us, have flesh and blood, he too shared in their humanity so that by his death he might destroy him who holds the power of death, that is the devil, and free those who all their lives were held in slavery by their fear of death. So Jesus said, be quiet, come out. Christy and I, we don't watch horror, we hate horror, but we love shows with magic in it. And what's interesting is that when humans write stories of magic and the supernatural, whether it's The Hobbit or Harry Potter, there's all kinds of special incantations, devices, formulas required. You need specialized training, you need knowledge, you have to say some words, never in your native tongue unless you're an elf. You need some special sauce, a little eye of the newt, a little hard-to-find flower, and it never hurts to wave around a magic stick. And then you have to raise your voice and bring forth an incantation, and something magical will happen. You can only hope your magic is stronger than the bad magic. What do we find here? Jesus says, shut up and leave. And the demons shut up and left. His words carry real power. He speaks. He wills work into existence. It's amazing that yesterday, I didn't see him, but there were some electrons traveling through the Y. They went into my iPhone. They made energy in the form of vibrations. Those vibrations vibrated my eardrum. My brain translated that into music. And it distracted me as I ran on a treadmill. And so Jesus speaks his will. He didn't have to make the sound waves. He did it, no doubt, for those around him. But his will has the power to bring things into existence or to control what's already in existence, in this case, these demons. So what is this? A new teaching and with authority, with power. Right on, you got it. This new-to-you teaching is powerful. It has effect in the real world. Christy and I were at a conference years ago, and unexpectedly to everyone there, there's about 1,000 people, the Lord just began to move in an unusual way, and people begin to be healed, instantly healed. And there's a couple of guys at least who roared like animals as this started happening and threw their chairs and ran out of the room and out of the building. I assumed they were demonized. And there was another time I've told you about where Christy and I and then Dave Haynes, who was in the first service, were there, and a man just all of a sudden began to speak in other voices, roared, tried to attack us. This isn't first century stuff. The internet didn't make demons go away. They were real then, they're real now. And Jesus was showing the realm of his effective will includes all of reality, seen and unseen. So he went next and demonstrated his kingdom authority by healing Peter's mother-in-law. Now remember, Mark's gospel is likely given directly to him by Peter. So this was a very meaningful event personally for Peter. So Jesus had authority over evil spirits, authority over illness. He's not just a teacher, but a teacher whose very words, which his words are verbalizations of his will. So his will has the power to impact the real world, the physical world. So he simply took her by the hand, helped her up, and the fever left her. He didn't say to her, you must confess your healing. He just healed her. Now, there's some wrong and often destructive thinking in the Christian subculture regarding healing and sickness, and it's important for me to address it. I'll summarize it right here. God wants everyone healed of every sickness. That's supposition number one. Number two, if you're sick, it's because of the sin of unbelief. Number three, if you want to be well, you must both confess your healing and refuse to even say you're sick. Positive confession, no negative confession. This is essentially a form of magic. It's not faith. And here are some results of this thinking. One, if you're sick, it is in some way your own fault. It becomes about assigning guilt. I have a friend who suffered greatly from an illness, and he received at least one letter rebuking him for his lack of faith, though he was actually revealing great faith in the midst of his suffering. Two, if you're sick and want to get well, you must deny you're sick. You must confess wellness. This has at least three negative consequences. Let me tell you what they are. First, it can kill you. Oliver and I had a good friend, Maurice, who would not confess sickness until the point he finally realized that this was not good theology, and he went to the doctor, and he died of a cancer that would have been treatable had he gone sooner. Second, it can keep you from asking for prayer and getting encouragement, because you cannot talk about what's really happening. You must invent a false reality, positive confession, rather than enlist help in your current reality. So you can't talk honestly and openly about your struggle with your friends. You can't include other people in the body in your struggle, because you can't move into negative confession, which is the same as saying, here's where I'm struggling. Here's where I'm sick. Help me think this through. Pray for me. And then it keeps you from encountering the real God in the real world in real ways, because what does God want from us if not honesty? God, I'm sick. I don't want to be sick. Help me. Speak to me. Jesus cried out to God in the midst of his suffering that if it were possible, would God take this from him? But he surrendered to the will of God, and the will of God included the failure of his physical organs. Paul pleaded over and over for God to take a physical affliction from him, but eventually discovered that God's strength was revealed in his own physical weakness. So here's the positive confession of Jesus and Paul: not my will, but yours be done. Mark made a negative confession here. He said she was sick in bed with a fever, and then Jesus healed her. Jesus can still heal. I've been there when he's healed people, miraculously, instantly. But he clearly doesn't heal everyone, and all physical healing this side of eternity is temporary. Think about it. Peter's mom is not still walking around, so she eventually got sick again of something. Sickness is a physical malfunction. Death is the ultimate physical malfunction. And those who claim that sickness is a result of a lack of faith must face the fact that death is the loss of healthy physical functioning. So all who die, by that reasoning, die of a lack of faith. No one dies of death. People die of something, some accident, some disease. And a disease is a disorder or a structure or function in a human body. So death means something stopped working. You say, what about someone who dies of old age? Well, the National Center for Health Statistics discourages physicians from listing old age as a cause of death. Ron's a coroner, and he could say old age, but something stopped working. We die because something stopped functioning. So if this view was correct, real faith should make you physically immortal. But that's not even a good or biblical goal in the present state of things. And the section ends with people bringing their sick and demon-possessed to Jesus, and he healed many of them, it said. In the Bible, the miracles of the Lord were called signs and wonders. They were signs, which means they pointed to something other than themselves. There is no sign that points to itself. Sign here. There's no sign like that. A sign points to something. And what they pointed to was the gospel. He didn't build a series of faith healing centers. He didn't build hospitals. He trained messengers to deliver the message of the gospel. The gospel is news and invitation about the kingdom. The signs pointed to the purpose. And the signs were designed to create wonders, curiosity, to open ears and eyes to the message of his authority. So he's saying, I am the king. I have authority. Now watch. But many got sidetracked by the watch. They got sidetracked by the healings. They confused his coming with purely physical purposes. But the good news of the kingdom being at hand was relationship with God was now possible through Jesus. The gospel was never an infomercial for physical health. It was the good news of peace with God through Jesus. So the king announced the news of his dominion, his authority, then he put his authority on full display. Now, even though the majority of Americans would profess Christianity as a religious profession or preference, most of those Americans consign their faith to the semi-real or the somewhat mythological category. So there's the real, where they live, and then there's the sort of real, the church world, or their belief world. And so the miraculous has been discarded, the historicity of the Bible has been rejected, and for a while, there was a remnant of Jesus' ethical teaching, but even that's now not part of the narrative, so it's been thrown away. It's sort of an outdated artifact of a simpler, less scientific time. But let me tell you what Christianity is. It is a coherent philosophical system. It best explains the world of humans and atoms and stars as it is. It is not just a philosophical system. It's more than that, but it's not less than that. It's historically verifiable. It lines up with the human narrative going back to the beginning. It's not just that, but it's certainly not less than that. It's more than that. It's personally verifiable. We can, in fact, and any human can, in fact, taste and see that the Lord is good. You can verify the gospel with your life. And then you can reject him. Either way, you're going to prove him true either way. And the truth of God explains why most of humanity sees up as down and down as up. And I said that the key verse for the book of Mark is Mark 10:45. The Son of Man didn't come to be served, but to serve, and to give his life as a ransom for many. And the context there was, in your world, Jesus said, the highest goal and achievement is to get to a place where people serve you. He said, but in my world, the apex of human existence is to serve others. This is his world. And if we continue to live upside down in his world, it's no wonder people continue to crash. It's been fascinating for me to read stories of pilots who have become disoriented, either because of a temperature inversion, they look out and the layers of air cause the sky to act like a camera lens, and so it flips the landscape. Or one pilot I read about confused the city lights with the sky above. But at any rate, pilots have over the years turned their plane and driven themselves into the ground. And their perception of reality clashed with reality, and that wrong perception became their undoing. So what are some implications and applications of the following statement in your life? He taught with one with authority. He taught as one with authority. What are some implications for your life? Not just sort of Sunday school applications, but I'm talking about in your whole life, a world where there's no upstairs and downstairs, there's just spiritual and physical realities. He taught as one with authority. This is the world that God has made, a world that is both physical and spiritual, a world where his will is the organizing principle for reality. And so we need to align our will with his will. Let's go back to that Hebrews 2 verse. Since the children have flesh and blood, he too shared in their humanity so that by his death he might destroy him who holds the power of death, that is the devil, and free those who all their lives were held in slavery by their fear of death. It's interesting that the verse doesn't say death holds humans in slavery, but the fear of death. The fact that our life ends in death dictates most of human activity, whether it's denial or stacking up stuff or fear. But at any rate, it is this fear of death that drives a lot of human behavior. And even those who say, and I've had people tell me, I don't fear death and I don't fear God. And my thought is always, time will tell. This Nazi war criminal that this chaplain ministered to, he was, the year and a half he was on trial, he'd come in every day, get up in his cell, he'd polish his boots, put on his uniform that had been stripped of rank. He'd go in there, and he was this Nazi general, and composed himself fearlessly. When they gave him the verdict, you're going to hang, composed himself fearlessly. Think, there's a guy that doesn't fear death. Until the minute he walked into the gallows, then he began to weep like a child. The fear can be subtle and beneath the surface, even as it's driving behavior and attitude. So as we think about the power of the devil leaving us, because this is our Father's world. The spiritual and the physical are all real, and death is not going to be the end of us. Death doesn't separate us from life. What if we spend some time anticipating, I wonder what I'm going to be doing 5,000 years from now in this kingdom of God, instead of just anticipating, how many more years do I have left? You know, the most widely sang and played hymn in Western civilization for years has been Amazing Grace. And here's one line. When we've been there 10,000 years bright shining as the sun, we've no less days to sing his praise than when we first begun. His authority, his dominion is over life and death, and the spiritual and physical world are not separated by some kind of barrier. The only barrier for us is perceptual, not actual. So let me finish with a story. Told the story before, but it's a very pertinent story to this morning. Years ago, I was in a hospital room holding on to a friend's hand. We called him Bear. His wife was asleep across the room, exhausted from her deathbed vigil. And I was whispering in Bear's ear and praying for him. And he would squeeze my hand when I would say, do you get what I'm saying? He would squeeze my hand, but he was in his last minutes. And then when Bear died, I prayed for him, squeezed my hand, and then he died. And there was no sounds, no bells went off or whatever. They didn't have him monitored that way because it was the end. no sound. He just stopped breathing. And it was really like what C.S. Lewis said, leaving this life to the next, is where you step between one room and the next, and you're still hearing the voices in this room, and you're hearing the voices in the next room. You're kind of in between rooms. And I thought, it was perceptually, that was happening there. I thought, I'm feeling, sensing this happening in the room. You say, well, that was just kind of psychological stuff. It really, you can think that, but you'd be wrong. His wife was asleep, sound asleep, exhausted. And as soon as Bear left the room and no sound was made, she sat up with a start and looked over at me. And I just shook my head. I mean, it woke her up. It, meaning Bear transitioning, woke her up. This is my Father's world. The battle is not done. Jesus, who died, will be satisfied and earth and heaven be won. That's the world you live in. You don't leave the upstairs world here at church where we talk about sort of real and then go out to your work and your home and your school where you live in the really real. That's nonsense. This is my Father's world. Let's pray. Talk to God and then listen to God, and then we're going to finish worshiping God this morning.